3, episodes 5 and 6 are over, but we are just getting started here on the Black Mirror Recap on Post Show Recaps. Hello, everyone. Mike Bloom here talking about the final 2 episodes of Black Mirror's 3rd season. They came and went as quickly as a hailfire of bullets. But, of course, I'm not alone. I am joined by a guy who knows a thing or two about roaches as well. AJ Mass, how you doing?
I am doing great. I mean, did you see the episode, Mike? I was in Black Mirror. They were talking all about the mass in their head.
Yes, exactly. I thought it was just, you know, the voice in my head that I've been hearing for the past couple of years. I didn't realize everyone else was in on it as well.
Yeah, no, it's great. I was like, I'm in Black Mirror. Woohoo!
Well, I think I speak on behalf of everyone where if we lived in a world where there was no AJ Mass, it would be as dark and bleak as was shown without Mass in the show.
Aw, you're so sweet. I mean, that's great. And if there were no bees, then there would be no Bloom.
That's very true, though. In this case, you might want to have less bees, considering what happened to those 387,000 people.
All I can think right now is comedian Eddie Izzard. I'm covered in bees.
Oh, I see. I could only think of Nicolas Cage in the remake of Wicker Man. The bees, not the bees. So I guess that speaks to it speaks to you being an Anglophile and me just being obsessed with Nicolas Cage.
There you go. As we all are, sure.
I got this national treasure here, my Ghost Rider.
So it's been so quick, AJ. Only 6 episodes in this 3rd season, but the most episodes in 1 season that Black Mirror has seen. Of course, we finish off with 2 very interesting episodes, one set in the military, one could arguably be Black Mirror's take on a whodunit. So, again, I can't say this enough about how much Black Mirror is really able to play a lot with genre and tone just under the general umbrella of technology. It really is fantastic.
It just goes to show that if you just take the time to think a little bit outside of the box, you know, you can really go anywhere. It's like you've done improv, I know, and I have as well. And it's just like, you know, that suggestion can come in from the audience, and it can be technology, but it can go anywhere. And I just love the fact that this is a show that can consistently stick to the theme, but yet play so many different Glenn Gould-esque variations on that theme.
Well, let's start by coming in hot and talking about Men Against Fire, which is our Army-based episode. AJ, what did you think about Black Mirror's take on the military?
Well, I liked the episode as a whole. I was a little concerned at the beginning. I really thought when they were talking about the roaches at first.
District 9 Part 2?
I was thinking Starship Troopers. I was just saying, you know.
Again, that's showing our generational divide.
Yeah, I was like, do you want to know more? But I was thinking just, you know, where's Doogie? Where's Doogie? You got the Casper Van Dien character. You got the Denise Richards character. I mean, this was very much I thought they were literally going to be insects at first. You know, it was going to be some sort of alien kind of thing. That's where I thought it was going. It very much was in the style of Starship Troopers. So that's where I thought we were headed. I was very glad when they didn't go there. But I there was nothing really that surprised me about this episode. I think it was very on the nose in terms of once you realize that, you know, there's somebody harboring the roaches and, you know, Doogie kind of turned into Anne Frank at that point. And, you know, we kind of heard about the Trumpiness of it all where it's like, you know, oh, they're the others and we got to treat the others, as bad. The technology aspect coming in with the, let's brainwash the soldiers into seeing them as others was interesting. I liked the way it played out, but I never, you know, Black Mirror always surprises me, and this one didn't surprise me.
Yeah, I'll admit this one probably felt the most heavy-handed with its social commentary. I mean, I think this is probably one of the most timely ones, considering, as you just mentioned, we have major political figures talking about the otherness and really painting people in a horrible light. And so I think they did an interesting job of really talking about, you know, you may paint someone as insect-like and how they're a scourge on society, but they're actually a person underneath all that, just an innocent person that doesn't want to get shot at the end of the day. But it was something that I wouldn't say I saw it coming, but I could definitely see the wire showing a little bit in the beginning of the episode. I mean, I brought up District 9 before, and there was a very similar thing like that, right? Where it was, oh, these alien creatures are so scary and so inhuman, but then once we see Charlotte Copley turn into one, you start to realize, oh no, they actually are much closer to us than we initially thought.
Yeah, too bad Nicolas Cage wasn't in that. We could have called it the Wickest Man.
Not the grasshoppers. No, not the grasshoppers.
I am Wickest.
Yeah, so again, I talked about this in Nosedive, but considering that I had seen something like this, and not even District 9, I mean, you can take all these sort of situations like Pocahontas, Avatar, Dances with Wolves, these situations where an outsider comes into a group that has been regarded as savages, learns their ways, learns that they're not savages after all, and then sort of rebels against his original troop is a trope that's been done a bunch of times. And I wouldn't say it followed it to the T. I felt like it was going there for a while until we got the final revelation with Michael Kelly talking to Stripe in the white, not padded room about what the mass system is truly about.
Yes, yeah. There were enough ways it could have gone that they kind of like, even though they were hitting the allegory on the head, certainly to the point of having a hidden room, you know, where I know you're a religious man, but these people, you know, you could just have replaced the word Jews there and it was the Holocaust. You know, certainly the heavy handedness there was absolutely there. But for me, there was still at least some element of potential ways it could have gone. And of course, when I'm watching these episodes, that's where my brain is going. I'm trying to figure out, is there a bigger twist than what I'm seeing here? You know, with the way his hand was always moving, you know, at first I thought he was maybe using a joystick and he was in a virtual reality. Then as they started talking about roaches, I thought, you know, what if these soldiers are actually insects? Pretending to be human because their hands were moving in a kind of insect-like way. That's what I was thinking next. Any of these twists would have been maybe just as interesting, just as not interesting. I don't know, but that's where my brain was going for these. You know, once he meets the roaches but sees them as humans, you know, I don't think there was anything necessarily about the action we saw that was surprising to me. We can get to the not padded room in a second, but what did you think about where it was headed up until that point?
Yeah, again, it seemed to be, I wouldn't say formulaic, but I could definitely predict like, oh, the people he saved are going to save him. And Ray is the trigger happy one who's going to wake up and sort of serve as the antagonist. We talked about this at the end of San Junipero about how you felt that the conflict sort of came and went very quickly. I felt like this conflict sort of came and went very quickly as well. They talked with Stripes talked with the roach woman for, what, like 2 minutes, then Ray bursts in and kills them all, and then all of a sudden he wakes up in the not padded room. That seemed to happen extremely quickly. Though, again, if they were following a well-worn path, I wouldn't want them to linger in it too long. I will say, again, I'm not condemning this episode too much because I think, as you mentioned in other podcasts, the performances across the board were all fantastic. And I love the little touches that it's still a war at the end of the day. Yes, you might have drones that you can view through your eyeballs that 3D map the place, and you have, you know, AR that bring up dossiers on people. But you still need to deal with the moral implications, and I don't want to make this a politicized thing about the military, but I'm assuming that there are moral implications you have to deal with of going out there and killing someone, of actively pursuing someone and terminating their life. And I think there's a really interesting idea in there of bringing these people under a reality where they feel like they have to kill these people, that they don't feel human, that they're basically going to contribute to the end of society. And again, it goes back to this idea that things like the media and certain pundits have built this sort of fervor about people. So again, this is one of the cases where we're not too far away from this type of future that Brooker is suggesting.
Yeah, I mean, what I really liked about the explanation and everything, you know, and where the episode gets its title is The Men Against Fire, is this kind of thing that he explains where, you know, soldiers in the war, World War I and World War II, you know, they didn't do it. They didn't shoot people. They shot over their heads. They didn't shoot, and then when they finally trained to the point where they could shoot, they didn't shoot to kill, because there is this kind of human against human thing that, you know, we're not going to kill our own species kind of thing. It's hard to do. And so this technology that they created was to eliminate that kind of thing and create this falseness where you think you're killing something that is other, because you see it as other, and your senses are altered to consider it another, so you have no problem actually shooting to kill. I thought that was fascinating. The even more terrifying thing, I think, was that this didn't seem to be a political war. This didn't seem to be a war where it was like anything more than they actually have the genetic codes of these people and are trying to wipe out imperfect people. I mean, this is eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Nazism. You know, this is a horrible, horrible thing. You're killing innocent people who are guilty of nothing but having DNA that might lead to disease somewhere down the line. I mean, that's insane. And yet it's acceptable in this society. And it's a terrifying society to live in, I think. And yeah, it's not that far off. I'm glad we're not looking into recessive genes and things like that as our prejudices. But, you know, it doesn't make it any better than the superficial stuff.
Yeah, put those Punnett squares away, people. We're a little while away from genetic exploration. And this is one of those episodes where you can kind of look back as a viewer and hang your head in shame, because, I mean, let's compare the two views of when Stripes kills those roaches. And it's really interesting. I had taken a note that the first time we see Stripes, you know, take that guy with a knife, we see it pretty much from his first person perspective. And it was a really interesting difference from what we saw from him for the rest of the episode. Then when Arquette reveals what the reality was to him, and we see the difference between him essentially doing something out of, you know, The Lost Boys or The Walking Dead and sort of just stabbing this non-human creature over and over and over again is taken in much differently than this guy, this innocent man who is, you know, basically begging not to be touched whatsoever, and to just have Stripes stab him malevolently over and over and over again. Two completely different takes, and I think it really knocks the point home of how perception really is reality in that case.
Yeah, but and on top of that, I mean, it's the really horrifying thing where they say, you know, he asks the question like, well, if that's what I see, then what do the villagers see? They don't have this altered reality. Like, why do they hate the roaches so? Because we tell them to. You know, we're basically telling them, we're not going to kill you, so they're fine with it. I mean, they're collaborators. It's horrible, but that's totally what we see in our society now, when you get this, okay, those are the bad guys. Okay, they're the bad guys. Well, how do you know if they're the bad guys? You're just being told by the media. And it's not even just necessarily in you know, the case of Muslims and the ban on Muslims that Trump is proposing, something like that. It's just, you know, that country is bad. You've never been to that country. You don't know. How do you know?
Well, one of the things that I feel like was a little bit of a sticking point, for me at least, were the one-note characters that existed outside of Stripe. I thought Stripe did a great job as a really intriguing protagonist. I think Malachi Kirby was just a great sort of stoic, but still also kind of an open book, I guess, in a way, where we're experiencing things literally through his eyes. So when he starts glitching out, we're freaking out alongside with him. These other characters did feel a little cardboard cutout, like, especially, you know, Raymond is, I'm glad that they might have gone against gender stereotypes, where I feel like that trigger happy person might have been a man in other war mm-hmm. pictures and other war depictions. It's nice that it went to a woman and that the commander was played by a woman. But Michael Kelly was, you know, the man in the suit behind a desk explaining this really murky technology. It might have been something that held me back a little bit from taking in the episode entirely. What did you think, AJ?
I think I agree with you in the first half of it, but in retrospect, the fact that their brains and moods and like all the things that make them individuals is taken away by this technology. They don't smell. They don't. They see what they're programmed to see. So the fact that they are cardboard cutouts, that's the intent of this technology. So I actually like it. The fact that our one character who's experiencing the glitches is the one who starts to exhibit more humanity and more character and is more interesting, I think works for the episode's main points.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And it's also, again, an interesting warp on perspective where when we see the Roach shine the neuralizer-like device in Stripe's face at first, we're thinking, oh no, this is the enemy getting back at our hero. He's trying to glitch him out. When it turns out that no, he was actually doing that to try to, bring him onto the side of humanity and break his mass device to make him see actually what he's doing.
Yeah, it's definitely... It's a very interesting thing where the technology was rudimentary, but it worked, and it's the disdain that the powers that be have for these inferior creatures. It's like it's just fascinating that these inferior creatures. Hey, Michael Kelly, they just subverted your entire system. So how inferior could they be?
And tell me a little bit about your thoughts on this ending. Throughout this episode, we get this sort of dream weaver, this dream woman, if you will, from Stripe's perspective. And obviously when he starts glitching out, the multiplicity of it all starts to come out a bit. But when he's faced with the choice of, you could put the mask back in, install it, basically reinstall it and forget this conversation that you had and sort of live in ignorant bliss, or become incarcerated and have these horrible memories play over in your head. He chooses the former. It seems like he's honorably discharged, and he makes his way home, and there's this very stark contrast where in his vision, he sees this warm, sunny home where there's a welcome back sign strung up and the woman of his dreams comes out to greet him. Contrasted with this dull gray environment where it's a dilapidated house and there's nobody coming out to greet him. What did you think about this idea of what they were affirming, that this dream woman was made up by the mass system the entire time?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was the case or not. It is ambiguous, and I think intentionally so. My initial instinct was to think that actually it was a real person from his past, someone who he did love and was deemed to be a roach and had been killed. And not necessarily by him, but that was my feeling, that he's going back to the house that she does indeed or did indeed live in and was there. And she's not there anymore because, like all roaches, she was exterminated. And that's kind of where the tear drop kind of comes in for me. But it's totally ambiguous. It could just be a completely made up person as well.
Yeah, I was expecting like Martin Lawrence's Big Mama to walk out, that it's not an attractive woman. It's this big behemoth of a woman that comes out to greet him, that's been with him the entire time.
I don't think he would necessarily have chosen Shanae.
Do you think Black Mirror would have jumped the shark had they brought in Martin Lawrence to play Big Mama for one episode?
Yeah, well, unless they do one of those shut up and dance things where they have Martin Lawrence coming out against Tyler Perry as Medea and have the two of them fight to the death, that might work for me.
Yeah, or if they do like what they did in Nosedive with the translated Home Improvement reruns, if we got like some Martin reruns on the next car that you're using from a rental system.
Oh, you look crazy. Oh, that's the vibra.
Now you're sounding like the roaches.
Oh no. It's the mass system in my own head that's screwing me up here.
You got a mass system in your own head as a mass? I feel like that's cautionary, isn't it?
It's just peeling back the layers.
Any other thoughts you have about this episode before we turn to our supersized season 3 finale?
No, I mean, I like the episode. I think it's a very important episode in terms of what's going on today. And I don't know when the script was written in terms of the relation to the current campaign and everything, but it would seem to me it would have to have at least started before by a bit. So again, this just might be another case where the prescience of these episodes is coming to the fore, because it felt much, much more imminent than other episodes in terms of, I mean, certainly the technology isn't there, but certainly the attitudes behind the technology were.
What, how would you feel about, and again, this is a big restructuring of the episode, but how would you feel if the majority of it took place in Arquette's office and just a conversation between him and Stripe? I know that obviously we have to have Stripe attacking the roaches in the beginning to have that stark contrast to the end, but I don't know. I thought that the teaser seemed to indicate, you know, they really showed that scene between the two. And I thought for a second that it was going to be like a bottle episode of Black Mirror, where it would be the two of them mainly in a room and Arquette would just slowly but surely be revealing details about the mass system to Stripe. Again, that's a totally different type of episode. But if that happened to go in that direction, how do you think it would compare to this version?
I think I might have found it. I mean, I might have found it more interesting, especially because I enjoy those kind of cat and mouse kind of type episodes, although I think it probably would have been too similar to the Christmas special episode and the interrogation going on with John Hamm. And also, it probably, just for me, I probably would have felt it being a little bit more of a Mr. Robot type thing where, you know, Elliot in with talking to a psychiatrist all the time. I think I might have gotten that vibe a little bit more, and so I don't know if I would have felt it to be as fresh. Not that I felt that this episode was fresh, but I might have felt it was even staler if they had gone that route.
Yeah, it's just like a random rewrite thought that I come up with.
And
it would have been, it definitely would have been a different thing, but it could have been, obviously when you do a military episode, you want to see action out there in the field. But I thought it could have been interesting to maybe have it orient around Stripe meeting with Arquette in his office and maybe doing occasional flashes to Stripe in the field. So that, again, it really orients around the information that Arquette's revealing rather than Stripe actually experiencing it. Again, a totally different feel, but maybe it could have been a very different way to do this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these episodes are rarely perfect, but they capture a mood and a feel, and I think this was not necessarily one of my favorite feels, but it definitely had its own unique feel to it. So I appreciate it. It's not like all other episodes I've seen in Black Mirror.
Well, let's talk about another episode that has an definitive feel to it, and that it is the longest episode of Black Mirror to date. It is basically the length of a feature-length movie at 89 minutes. The finale, hated in the nation. Was this hated by the mass nation, not those that had the technology in their heads?
Didn't like the title. so just want to go out on the record there. Teeth of Consequence would have been a much better title. But I would say that if you told me that they had greenlit this for a weekly series, I would be setting my season pass on my DVR right now. I love these characters. I want to see Park and Blue solving crimes from here on out. I thought
Park and Blue sounds like a street coordinate. Like, I'll meet you at the corner of Park and Blue.
It's UK Blue.
Is that going to be a pin that the company dropped for Kenny and Hector to pull up?
Something like that. I love this episode. I thought the acting and the characters were just fantastic. I was, again, like the first 30 minutes, I was concerned because it was so obvious to me that it was the bees that had killed our Joe at the beginning. And so I was just like, oh, if the big reveal is the bees, then I'm just going to be really pissed. But they found out, like, you know, just 5 minutes later, they're just like, no, it's the bees. Okay, good. And it went in a completely different direction. And I just was along for the ride. I loved it.
Yeah, this is like, take note, HBO, this is like what True Detective Season 3 should be like. I definitely got like a True Detective vibe from the two of them initially, that like one was a little bit of an odder duck and the other one was a little more set in their ways. This was like a combination of True Detective and CSI Cyber, considering the work that Blue did. I mean, I'll admit when I first looked at it being 89 minutes, I was a little concerned because we've dealt with episodes in the past where I felt the pacing was a little off and that certain episodes didn't necessarily need to be an hour. You can certainly get a same amount of storytelling done in 40 plus minutes. But I agree. I ate up every part of this. It was just so intriguing. And even when we found out what and who it was. There were still twists at the end that made it super memorable and super mysterious, and the messaging behind it was really on point. It's very poignant today. This is essentially, I feel like, Charlie Brooker's dissertation on internet trolls, which is fantastic, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but everything was just firing on all cylinders in this episode. This, to me, might be like the most perfect episode of Black Mirror we've experienced so far.
I just think they nailed the tone. This was also, to me, this was the most British of the episodes. This was a British procedural, and I've watched a lot of British procedurals. I mean, you and I have podcasted about Broadchurch.
Yeah, speaking of pedophilia.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's pedophilia in this episode of Hating the Nation.
I love the running theme of pedophilia, but maybe your own theory about the obsession with pedophilia in Britain is very much represented in Black Mirror season 3.
I'm just saying it's in the zeitgeist there for whatever reason. But yeah, I just love British procedurals. I watch them wherever I can. In fact, a week from now, on Netflix is season 3 of The Fall is coming up, which is Gillian Anderson and what's his face from 50 Shades,
Jamie Dornan.
First two seasons were phenomenal, and I'm excited about season 3. And it's a British procedural, and this nails the tone of what that's all about. Hello, I'm your shadow. Like, that's something they do in British procedurals. Like, there's always an outsider who comes in to kind of be a fresh set of eyes who isn't connected to the department. So if there's any chicanery going on, they can blab to the higher ups. It just was a perfect setup. Their personalities were great. They followed leads even when they didn't believe in them, which is something you almost never see in American shows, where it's just like, oh, no, that couldn't possibly be. Let's just leave it. And, they bring it back in the third act for a twist. No, they followed the evidence where it led. And I was along for the ride, like a bee searching for the hive.
Yeah, we're definitely a hop, skip, and a jump away from the Law & Order SVU trope of, like, they'll go to one guy and, oh, it obviously won't be him. Let's bring in the clear perpetrator. Oh, no, it turns out it wasn't him, and it was the first guy the entire time. I'm glad that we definitely avoided that. And I know last podcast I talked about how Black Mirror sometimes likes to bring faceless antagonists into things, particularly these like nationwide hacks, which again is very timely considering that, again, the day that these episodes dropped, there was a nationwide hack. But here they actually brought a face to it, albeit one that's going to change. But I'm sure we'll get to that. I want to hear from you, AJ. What is your thought about the concept of this episode? This idea that this guy has sort of started this a campaign, I guess, where if you use a certain hashtag, you can accumulate enough support for someone to send killer bees after someone and murder one person each day that you feel like is inherently a bad person and needs to die.
You know, when you describe it like that, it sounds absolutely preposterous. And yet it seems so real in this world that they created. Just, they explain right off the bat that, okay, there's this bees that have died out, and that has happened. I mean, there have been, colony collapses, and bees are in trouble. So they've invented these drone bees to pollinate our flowers and keep the fruits and vegetables going. And they established that really subtly in the beginning. And the fact that someone is able to weaponize them and tie it to Twitter trolls and a wave of hate, which is also the examples that they used are so were so valid. I mean, yes, there have been people who have done stupid things like take selfies at places they're not supposed to, and everybody on the internet hates them and attacks them. It's just weaponizing that hate, and it's totally believable.
If this existed today, how long ago do you think Justin Bieber would have died? Really putting the B in Justin Bieber.
I don't know that he would have, because I think just all the believers would have gotten together and upvoted someone else to take.
AJ, the man talked about Anne Frank and said she would have supported him. I feel like that's comparable to Clara pissing on a war monument.
Well, he didn't call her a roach, so at least that's okay. Look, I think, we get that all the time. I mean, with this I mean, Crooked Hillary is going on now. I mean, that hashtag it just goes bouncing around and bouncing around and bouncing around. You get, I'm sure when Kanye West went on stage and I'm gonna let you finish, everyone's like, shut up, Kanye.
Yeah, that's our Tusk analog right there.
Exactly. You know, yeah, these things happen and people, it happens. And I totally buy that this kind of hate and this kind of hashtag, even if it was done in jest, this kind of hashtag would absolutely catch on. The fact that it's happening without people knowing it, it makes it a little subversive. But, if anyone actually knew that the game was going on and submitted the hashtag, then I think, again, they're not guiltless in what evidently happens to them at the end. It's the people who did it at the beginning that you're just like, well, just because they put the hashtag in, they might not have known the game was going on. I think that's where the slight disconnect is. But but I still loved every bit of this plot. It made total sense from beginning to end.
But I feel like that disconnect isn't there, though, because you realize when you look back on the words that you were saying death to somebody, and it goes back to this point that Garrett and, by proxy, Brooker are trying to make, which is when you are online, as I've talked about in previous episodes, you're able to shroud yourself in this sort of veil of anonymity, where you are free to say whatever you want without any sort of consequence. Yes, CSI Cyber, cybercrime divisions have grown in the past, and I think more people have been punished for things. I mean, I don't remember his name, but the Fox News guy that got banned from Twitter after insulting Leslie Jones so many times after Ghostbusters. I feel like that's a great example of that existing. But people are still, wishing death threats to people. As podcasters, you and I have probably both received probably not as extreme threats, hopefully not, but still big statements from people personally insulting us as well. And it's interesting to sort of have someone turn that braggadocio onto its head and say, well, put your money where your mouth is. You're going, if you wish death on somebody, this is what you're going to get. It's just so fascinating to me because I feel like something like a death threat has really been mitigated in the age of the internet, where it's something that you can easily do to someone. The fact that numerous reality TV contestants have received them periodically just for eliminating their favorite contestant when even, 20, 30 years ago, it was considered to be such a grave thing is so insane. And it speaks to the power of the internet and how much you can really disguise yourself and say what you really want to say without any sort of sense of consequence. So to really, this is bad to me to say, I was kind of rooting for Garrett. I was kind of rooting for, yes, these people might not have realized what they were participating in. At the same time, whether they mean it or not, they are still wishing death onto people. And it's also so fascinating to me because I definitely know there are some people I can think of who I would say, if they happened to die tomorrow, I would not be unhappy. And it's sort of, when do you cross that line and actually, the really fascinating part is when this game is revealed to the people and you have in a montage, you have people like calling into radio stations and really and saying, surprisingly enough, like, well, this could be a great way to eliminate someone like a racist or a murderer or a bigot. And you realize that if given the opportunity, some people might use this still as a way to carry out some sort of moral agenda to purge the planet of what they feel are people that don't deserve to be here anymore.
Yeah, no, yes, the fact that it's the hashtag is death too, and certainly after the fact that it's revealed that, oh yes, this is going to be a thing, anyone who participates at that point is totally, over the line, no question about it. It's a little gray at the beginning, if let's say it wasn't death too, it was just I hate or fire. As opposed to, the journalists at the beginning, fire Joe, like it's still affecting someone's life. And it's still a gray area, but, is it as bad, certainly for a public figure, when you start to get to the individual, the girl who just took a picture, then you're saying, well, she's not a public figure. So now we're talking about something that is getting a little closer to being 100% over the line. Even what she did was bad. You know, if people, a lot of people are going to say death to, and they're not going to really mean death to. It's you know, certainly I can't condone most of the diatribes and the invectives and the tenor of the discussions in the Twitterverse and on social media. Absolutely not. But I think the teacher put it very well. It's like, well, I wasn't serious about it. You know, like we got her a cake. We got her a cake. We pitched in and we got her a cake. That's not mental. You know, we were just mad at her. She said some horrible things. And yes, getting someone a cake is not horrible. And the woman didn't take it as horrible. You know, she was like, yeah, it's a cake. It tastes good. You know, so it is a very difficult fine line to draw. And I think it's not until it's revealed that this is what's going to happen that you should be able to really blame these people. You know, the fact that the teacher was involved in the bee attack at the end, I'm like, well, she did it the first time. I don't think she really meant it.
Yeah, though, again,
I think what you're saying doesn't really 100% excuse it either.
Yeah, I think if Shut Up and Dance is any indication, I feel like this teacher might have a darker history that we don't even know about, and it sort of just balances things out, karmically speaking.
Yeah, well, this is true. I mean, but she got her cake.
What did you think? The one thing I will say, I wasn't as big of a fan this episode. I'm not a huge fan of the media res technique of, oh, let's start in the middle of a big event and then flash back to it so it leads up to that moment. What did you think about constantly cutting in, not constantly, but a few select times over the course of this episode to this hearing that Karen is undergoing as to what exactly happened over the course of those 4 or 5 days?
You know what? I didn't mind it because it wasn't really intrusive. I felt it worked for me. I know what you're saying, that it tends to become a crutch for a lot of structural formats. You know, obviously the person you see testifying, you know they didn't die because they're the one giving testimony. So, you know, it's that kind of thing. It's often done in a Rashomon style also, where you get different people testifying and you get their different versions of events. That's also something that happens. I didn't mind it in this case because, again, the characters were so interesting. The story was so the momentum just built and built and built that it was ancillary to me. I didn't feel like I was watching something that was being told to me where I already knew the ending.
So talk to me about your thoughts on these two main characters specifically. I guess they're the Rizzolian Isles of Black Mirror. Kelly MacDonald as Karen and Faye Marseille as Blue. What did you think about this dynamic duo? Did they leave you feeling blue?
No, they left me feeling rosy and joyful. I like I said, I want them to have their own series. I want them on my TV as often as possible. They were fantastic. I just loved the dynamic, the kind of the banter that was going on. It was very natural. The Britishness of it, like, you know, steady. Just such a British word. I love the relationship. It was, you know, you're maybe you're too young, maybe you're too old. It felt natural, and yet they respected each other, and they both did their jobs very well.
Yeah, I feel like they balanced each other out very well. Admittedly, I was not a huge fan of Karen to begin with. I think Kelly MacDonald did a great job with the performance, but the character itself I felt like was too weathered and too skeptical of everything, especially when the internet narrative was involved. I'll admit, last podcast we talked about an interview that was done on Fresh Air with Charlie Brooker. The concept of the Death 2 hashtag was spoiled to me in that episode, so I knew it was what was happening. So I was then, you know, a little resentful of Karen for constantly saying, like, oh, the internet's only half heat, you know, don't go down that trail, we're going to arrest the husband, it's almost always the husband. But she definitely warmed up into it, which I was glad to see. And Blue was just such a fun character as well, to be so wide-eyed and naive, and I wouldn't say happy, but so embracing of this culture, especially after it seems like she had left her unit after dealing with a particularly nasty case in her previous workspace, and to really believe that, you know, out in the real world, you can genuinely prevent stuff, and they try to, and they are not able to prevent probably the biggest, you know, mass killing that has happened on Black Mirror thus far, I think is very, very poignant.
Yeah, it just was really, really It just felt genuine. It felt real. It felt like two people who were trying to solve a crime and were doing the best they could, and they do fall short because you can't stop everybody all the time. And the way their different perceptions of and where they go, the directions afterwards were fascinating. And I love the bait and switch at the end where they were still working together, pretending that she had committed suicide, but Blue is actually on her own quest to find Dr. Lecter and having a friend for dinner there. I mean, it was very Silence of the Lambs, the ending there, where she's just following him off into the the sunset.
We thought Blue disappeared into the blue, but it turned out to be the blue sky of what looks to be some sort of Spanish-speaking country.
And, like, you know, I would love to see Blue hunt him down, you know, or, you know, the next case where we just, you know, a little, you know, reminiscing of, remember that time we caught the guy who leased the bees?
So talk to me about the bees. You mentioned them before, but to have them be these sort of murder weapons in this case, what do you think it says about the idea of technology and these autonomous ecological saviors? I guess I'll use that term.
Yeah, it's a real concern. I think it just in general is like, you know, we're getting closer and closer to that singularity. And when you have artificial intelligence of any kind, it's going to at some point do something that you're not expecting. I don't necessarily think that this wasn't a case where the bees were just doing this on their own, which you see a lot as a trope in these types of cautionary tales and science fiction and whatnot. This was somebody who was actually programming them to do this, so that it makes it a little bit different. But generally speaking, I mean, we have fears in our society about, you know, GMOs, like, you know, oh, you've touched the food and changed the food, it's going to kill us all. Like, you know, our food's been genetically altered from the get-go. You think bananas really look like that? No, they don't. It's genetic engineering. So, but people are afraid of genetic engineering. People are afraid of robots. People are afraid of artificial intelligence. And yes, there's reasons to not give it free rein. But at the same time, if it does the job, I mean, if you need it to replace the bees to prevent the ecology from collapsing, it makes sense why they would do it in this society.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a difference, though, between, like, we're being worried about GMOs and being worried about a situation where, like, oh, now the vegetables get to grow themselves because, as we can see, someone can, through a couple of quick hacks, easily manipulate the system and, you know, maybe put pesticides in those vegetables and kill a bunch of people. I think the minute that this guy, Rasmus, I think his name was, said that the bees were completely autonomous, that was a big red flag of, well, that's going to be your problem, because even when you're going to try to shut these bees down, even if there wasn't someone working behind the scenes, you talked about the singularity, there could be a good chance that these bees would rebel, and now we have a case of, you know, if the fear against African bees was big, I feel like this would be even bigger. And also to have the weapon be a literal drone, not the drone that was obviously purveying Kenny's fight to the death in episode 3, but to have it be all these bugs that sort of travel in packs and exist as part of a colony and really are sort of mindless, I think it speaks well towards, again, this point that Garrett is trying to make, where these people that are doing the Death 2 hashtag are almost their own form of drones, in that they're forming their own sort of colony. They're, I guess, hovering around this queen, though in this case it's a queen that they want to die rather than a queen that they want to have babies with or serve. And it's interesting that there's a lot of one-to-one similarities between having these bees, these drones, eventually disperse and kill the drones that contributed to the hashtag to begin with.
Yeah, it's symbolism to the utmost, and it works. It's this kind of the hive mind. Twitter is a hive mind, you know. So it makes total sense. I mean, I was also like, oh, they can reproduce. No, that's bad.
Yeah, and especially when they say it's just like 3D printing. Like, there's not even like a process involved. You can just press a button, and you're gonna have another bee there. That means that those bees are not dying anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, I thought when they first gave the report, it was just like, and for the second summer in a row, the you know, autonomous bees are going to be out there. I'm like, oh, okay, so they send them out for, you know, the summer, and then, you know, at the end of the summer they wear down and they die, and then they'll send out another batch. Like, that's what I thought was going on, and that made sense to me. But to have them just like released into nature and given the ability to reproduce, I'm like, no.
What did you think about the deaths themselves? That the bees were apparently given the orders to make their way into a person's head and essentially fly through and destroy what seems like, what, the pain center of the brain, where you go through an agonizing death, where it makes, in the case of Joe, want to kill herself. Luckily, I guess Tusk was spared that when his head just exploded in the MRI. But do you think there's some sort of symbolism behind the bee specifically targeting your pain sensor?
Not really. I don't necessarily think there was any symbolism there, other than, you know, the message, like, people like that deserve to die a painful death. And since the real targets were the Twitter people, let's make them die painfully. You know, how else are you going to kill them? You know, they are drone bees. You know, they don't actually have weapons on them, so it's kind of a gruesome death. You know, I've hated that kind of thought ever since Wrath of Khan, with the bug crawling in through the ear. So it's just nasty.
Yeah, I mean, they could do something out of The Happening. And for a second, specifically when they hold Clara up inside that house, it did feel a little bit like The Happening, but obviously much better than The Happening.
Yeah, because something happened.
Exactly. It didn't happen while they were off screen. But in The Happening, it was like, I don't know if the pain sensors were activated, but essentially these people sort of fell into a stupor where they just started walking backwards and saying unintelligible things and then just ended up killing themselves. I thought we were dealing with that for a second when we found out that Joe had slit her throat, but I guess it turned out she just wanted to end the pain, which I'm happy. The further that Black Mirror can stay away from M. Night Shyamalan, the better.
Yes, although I did like Sixth Sense and I did like Unbreakable.
Well, I think that's a very much agreed upon opinion. And I've heard, again, I'm not a horror person, but I heard The Visit was very good as well.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet, but I will let you know when I do. Hamster Factor? No, I won't do that to you.
Please, God, no. I already read the plot synopsis, so I already know the twist. So it would not behoove you for me to have me watch it anyway. So what did you think about this big reveal that it turns out all along Garrett had sort of led them into this trap? It was a very like Sherlock Moriarty type of thing where, you know, he puts up a picture of himself that has a geocode mapped to it in his manifesto, which leads them to this place where they find a drive that has the ability for them to stop it, but it turns out that there's a secret file in there that ends up sending the bees to go aggro. The map literally turns red to represent the anger of all these trolls that the bees are about to attack. We talked a little bit about it, but what did you think about this turn at the 11th hour?
I liked it. I liked the fact that it wasn't your simple, oh yes, well, we outsmarted him and he gets away and that's it. I mean, there was a point to it all. He suckered them in, he slow played them, and you know, it was on such a big grand scale. I mean, to me, what was amazing was the shot of all the body bags to show like how many people had been killed by this. You know, you could throw out a number out there. It doesn't really mean anything, but the visual of it was just like, oh, that's crazy. That's insane. To, you know, decimate a society literally.
Yeah. I mean, it was, that final montage was haunting. To have the bees descend on the people, including
the music,
one of the police workers. I love that song, hearing that singer, for lack of a better term, drone on. I love the lyrics, you know, tired are your splendid soldiers, tired are they, here they go. I mean, those are the bees, and those are the Twitter trolls as well. They're soldiers in a way. They were kind of weaponized to attack specific people, and they've been exhausted by the process, and now they're going to be firmly laid to rest. It was just a really beautifully shot and really haunting ending to this episode. Though it didn't turn out to be the exact ending of this episode, it was definitely a great note to end, I guess, this general timeline on.
Yeah, I just, you know, they when you're playing this deadly game of cat and mouse, you know, sometimes the cat wins and sometimes the mouse wins, and sometimes you both get hurt and, you know, live to fight another day. And that's,
yeah, we've seen Tom and Jerry, AJ.
All right, fine. But you know, Monsieur le Pussycat. I just think it was just really, really awesomely done. I the fact that you had this big event at the end that there was that moment where they had to decide whether or not to go through with it. Like, is this a trap or not? The fact that they were able to, you know, be on both sides of the no, I think it's a trap. No, this is our only chance to stop them. And that was so heart pounding to have them in that moment. Like, are you going to do the right thing? And he could have taken, you know, all four permutations there, you know, were still in play. I love when you can set that up, and it no matter how it goes, you know, it's not going to end well.
Yeah, I know I said Karen is the worst last time, but now I'm thinking Agent Sean Lee might be the worst, because he's the one that, you know, Blue and Karen are both sort of like, oh yeah, I don't know if we should do this, but Sean's like, nope. Execute. And he's the one who was, you know, he sort of represents the government that sort of had this happen to begin with, and that they sort of set up back doors through the ADI program to have the government spy on everybody through the bees, and that's how Garrett was able to get into the files. He tries to, you know, blow up the hive and have the bees attack his men. I didn't want to paint the government in a big, black, shadowy light, and I feel like they did a good job of not making it too stereotypical in that regard, but the character, let's remember, was the one to make this fate befall 387,000 people at the end of the day.
Yes, I mean, you can't really blame him because he didn't put the code in, but yes, certainly he's the one who hits the button, so...
Exactly. When you have that government power, you gotta be prepared to be the one to push the button. It's inherent.
Yeah, I know, but I did love his exchanges with the chancellor and that whole sequence where he's like, okay, yes, someone's going to die. We need to turn it off now so that – well, but you're in the lead right now. Okay, release. Let's get the pedophile.
Yeah, that, and I love that too. That's a fun little like – I'm sure Brooker could have totally spun off into another tangent about that, but I love the little political commentary in there about how the chancellor decides to throw a smear campaign against the guy who's ranked number four to try to save his own hide. It's fantastic.
It was fantastic. And, you know, just another thing that I don't know if you caught the couple of the Easter eggs there. I caught two of them, and there might have been more. But just – I just love anytime there's a TV screen and there's a news report going on, there's a crawl going across the bottom. As anyone – you watch CNN, Fox News, whatever, it's always – there's the crawl. But he puts in references to other episodes in the crawl, and it – one point there was a mention about the mass system, and there was another point there was a mention that Sato was releasing his new video game. It was just I love references to past episodes that they do, and the fact that this is number six kind of ties up the season so nicely.
Well, there are a bunch. We even skipped the one in Men Against Fire where Ray flat out sings the song from 5 Million Merits.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That Jessica Brown Findlay sings, and that was probably like the most obvious one. And I know you talked before about the whole shared universe theory. I'm still a little out on it until we get like one big theory that sort of brings them all together just because they're in such separate universes, but I love the Easter eggs. And I know that fellow podcaster here on Post Show Recaps, Antonio Mazzaro, pointed out a picture to me that he saw on Reddit of the first episode where I think if you pause one of the screens on Lacey's computer, you see a couple of news stories, and they refer to the prime minister scandal from the national anthem. I think they might make a reference to the trial from White Bear as well. So these Easter eggs are inherent. It's one big Easter party, I guess, through Black Mirror. Not necessarily connecting all these stories, but at least referring to them. I did not catch that, but it seems like it's really been inherent throughout the season.
Yeah, you know, I don't remember that being a nosedive. I wasn't looking too carefully. I thought that was from the Christmas episode, but
maybe it was the Christmas episode.
Yeah,
maybe
I think I caught those in the Christmas episode. There were a couple of things in there, including like the names on John Hamm's screen when he was helping all those people. Like one of them was Waldo, and like there were like references all throughout. So Brookard likes to plant those in there, and it really, even if it's not all these episodes are taking place in the same universe, which I don't really think is physically possible given the different technologies that are going on. The fact that they all kind of take place in the same universe, the Black Mirror universe, and they can kind of bleed into each other, I think is just fantastic. And yes, anytime that they're going to sing the Jessica Byron Findlay song, I will understand.
So give me your thoughts on the ending here. We have a couple of different things here. First, we go back to our present scenario where Karen has given her side of the story. And from what I gleaned in her being taken out from the car, it seemed like now she had become hated in the nation, which was a little weird because I don't think she would be directly to blame for it. I guess you would think that they would swarm more so around Garrett, but I guess because she sort of let it happen by not catching him in time, she's the one to blame. And then we get another reveal that Blue did not kill herself. As you mentioned, she has been pursuing Garrett the entire time, and it looks like they are about to literally round a corner on that case. What were your thoughts about the last, like, 5 minutes of that episode and of the season?
Yeah, I like the fact that, you know, yes, she does appear to be one of the most hated, if not the most hated in the nation, although perhaps she won't be after Lee testifies. Perhaps he will take his rightful place in that throne. But yeah, that many people die. I mean, they're obviously going to hate anyone who had any even ancillary in with it. And it's not her fault by any means, but it kind of is, sort of, kind of. So, but I like the fact that, you know, she's just going to have to live with that now. She's not going to have to worry about an attack of bees. So at least there's that.
Yeah, no, wait until the ants come after her now.
Exactly. Agony ants, completely different thing. But yeah, like I said, the end where Blue is still on the case and it has found him. I love that being left open that, like I said, to me, it was totally Silence of the Lambs. It was, you know, Hannibal Lecter calling back and saying, you know, I'm having him for dinner and I'm walking off after him. I just really liked having that as either a to be continued, fingers crossed, or just a we might still get the bad guy and the appropriate guilty party. He may have changed his face and everything. Yeah, for a second I thought she was going to take his picture and somehow take out that last bee that they had, you know, taken from mm-hmm. Tusk and like program it into that one last bee to kill him. But and who knows, maybe she will. But that's where I thought they were going. But just the fact that they left it hanging was also good. It was a nice little coda.
No, it's all about the robotic tequila worm that if they're down in Mexico. Yeah, and this is the episode where I believe Brooker said in an interview that there's a chance that these characters in particular might recur in the series in the future, which makes sense because I think that this, again, is Black Mirror's take on a procedural. I mean, I know Brooker was inspired by what he calls like Scandi-Noir thrillers like The Killing, or you might talk about like the Lisbeth Salander books. Our Scandinavians, for some reason, are like really great in terms of these crime procedural dramas. And so I could totally see a scenario where these two get back together and they're sort of on the next case. And again, this technology harkened really closely to what we have these days where it's not too far into the future. We're not in the 5 million merits universe or even the nosedive universe where this technology is so different and such an inherent part of our society that it makes things seem completely different. I feel like this could be a case where if it was a weekly show, you could have the two of them tackle a different technology every week. Again, that might be CSI Cyber's territory, but now that it's been canceled, I feel like the territory is wide open.
6 seasons in a movie.
Absolutely. So any other thoughts about the closeout of season 3?
No, just I thought it more than lived up to expectations. It surpassed them. You know, if with 6 episodes, like I said, I was concerned that it wouldn't be able to hold up, and I would have been thankful if we got 2 that I liked. I didn't hate any of them, and I loved 4 of them. So that's great percentage.
Yeah, absolutely, and. I had forgotten how much I needed this in my life in a way, because there are many, many fantastic shows out there. We're in the golden age of television, but I feel like nobody tells a story like Charlie Brooker. You know, the reason why The Twilight Zone is so legendary is because they were able to take these very simple, sometimes fantastical stories of irony and turn them into cautionary tales. And to have Brooker bring that into an age that is so obsessed with digital technology, basically everything that exists virtually, is so much fun to get to see, oh, what could take place now? What could take place in the future? What sort of ideas can he come up with? I mean, we've been spouting off of the mouth about how creative this man is, and I think this season definitely shows how he can work with basically any genre.
Yeah, and on top of that, to piggyback on what you just said, piggyback, not any other part of the pig. Sorry, yeah. Prime Minister. But no, to piggyback on that, like, we are talking about an anthology series, and each episode is self-contained. So this isn't like shows like Mr. Robot, like, you know, where you're trying to figure out the season-long twist and we're going to freeze frame everything and try and get all the clues. You are watching this one episode, and you have until this episode is over to maybe get ahead of the writer and figure out what's going on there. And I think it's much more challenging a task for the viewer. It's much more engaging because you don't have the luxury of watching this episode over and over and over again, because, you know, you're still six more episodes till the season finale when the big reveal is going to be. The big reveal is coming before the end of this episode, and you've got to watch it in real time. And I think there aren't enough shows that challenge the viewer in that way. And so I love the respect that he gives the viewer, that he's going to play with you. And sometimes you're a little bit ahead of him, and then sometimes he lets you be a little ahead of him and then steers in a completely different direction. But I love the game.
Absolutely. And then the simulation of the game, and then the simulation of that simulation of the game as well. AJ, I was not going to let you off the hook that easy. We need to give our personal rankings of these six episodes to finish things off. Now, I know you personally agonized last time about having to put episodes 3 and 4 in the spectrum. Did you have as hard of a time putting 5 and 6 in there as well?
No, I think these were a little bit easier to slot in there. I'm still of the mind that the weakest of the six is Nosedive, so that's going to definitely live at the bottom. And I'm going to put Men Against Fire at number 5. I liked it, but it was certainly the most familiar, the most recognizable of the six. I think it was a little bit meatier of a storyline, so that's going number 5. Then it's just a question, again, the other four, you could really just – if anyone tells me, no, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, any order I'm fine with. But for my official order, I'm going to put San Junipero 4. I'm going to put Hated in the Nation 3. I just really love the combination of acting and story the most for a single episode. Shut Up and Dance 2, Playtest 1. But like I said, as far as watching more and more with these characters, I would watch Hated in the Nation every week and 6 times on Sunday, you know.
So I guess number 0 for you is the upcoming Hated in the Nation TV series coming to, I don't know, BBC America.
Park and Blue, UK Blue, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So for mine, I guess I'm a little bit more polarized with these episodes than you might be, because they're going to take my top and bottom spots respectively. I was really debating before we came on between Hated in the Nation and San Junipero for my number 1, just because, again, I know San Junipero is so atypical to the Black Mirror tone, but I just love the stylization. I love the twist. I love the relationships it built. But honestly, this finale just blew me away and really excelled at every single aspect of the show and was very inherent to the messaging of the show to begin with. So that's going to eke it out by a nose that a bee flew into for me for number 1. So it's going to go for me from the top to the bottom: Hated in the Nation, San Junipero, then Playtest, then Shut Up and Dance, then Nosedive, and then Men Against Fire at the bottom. Not to say that, again, that I hated Men Against Fire, liked the concept that Nosedive did a little bit more. I thought Bryce Dallas Howard, again, put in a powerhouse performance. This, again, just felt too on the nose with the social commentary. I wasn't a big fan. I thought it was very, you know, impactful at the end, but I wasn't a huge fan of how the events transpired. So those are our personal power rankings for these 6 episodes. AJ, season 3 is in the can.
No! it was a great season. I am so happy we got a chance to talk about it. Not only because I enjoy talking about stuff with you, as you know, but also because there was stuff to talk about. It was many years in the making, and season 4 can't come soon enough.
Yeah, and we don't have to wait that long. We don't have to wait years. I think we just need to wait a year.
Considering which is great.
I guess I'd rather have 6 and 6 than have us do 12 all at once and then have to wait God knows how long for more Black Mirror. So that's nice. And yeah, I mean, I love talking with you about the stuff, hyperanalyzing the nitty gritty, the granular, if you will, of all of these things. And I want to thank you again for introducing me to this show, because it's a part of my life that I wouldn't want to live without. It's just such a fantastically dark, though sometimes with spots of light, show, and it's just so much fun to watch. But this is not the last time we are going to be talking about Black Mirror. Near the end of this week, we talked about it before, we're going to try to do a feedback show, but we're also going to bring in a special guest. For those of you that listen to the Big Brother coverage on Rob Has a Podcast, you may know a man / robot by the name of Taryn Armstrong. What you may not know about Taryn is that Taryn is a huge fan of Black Mirror. I think he actually called it his favorite show of all time. So I know Taryn's going to have a lot of thoughts about this most recently wrapped season. So we're going to bring him in, hear his takes, whether he agrees or disagrees with us on these 6 episodes. And we're hoping to hear from you guys as well. So please let us know any and all thoughts you have about this season and this series as a whole. Email us at feedback@postshowrecaps.com. You can tweet us as well. AJ is at AJ Mass. I am at a Mike Bloom type. Make sure you're locked into Post Show Recaps on iTunes as well. Go to postshowrecaps.com/iTunes to subscribe to our main feed, so you can be dialed into our coverage of Westworld, The Walking Dead, SNL, Seinfeld, Once Upon a Time. Like Charlie Brooker, we cover a wide variety of genres. So we'll be talking to you guys soon. But to finish things off here, AJ, do we have a hashtag for people who made it to the end of this podcast?
Oh, I'm a little scared to put a hashtag out at the end of this episode. Let me tell you.
Oh God. Yeah, do not click on what's been trending with Death 2. I actually, now that I've watched the episode, I might look into it to see how many Black Mirror diehards tried to get that trending.
We could go with Be Kind.
Be Kind. That's a good one. I also had Wickest Man down.
I like the Wickest Man. Yeah, I like the Wickest Man a lot.
Hashtag the WIKUS Man. And maybe we'll be pushing for Nicolas Cage to star in District 9 Part 2 coming at some point, directed by Charlie Brooker, I'm assuming. It turns out that it was a big virtual reality the whole time.
I've got a mirror! The mirror's black!
And all the aliens were actually U.S. presidents the entire time. It all makes sense. Thank you guys so, so much for listening to our coverage. This has been so much fun to talk about, and I look forward to wrapping it all up with Taryn Armstrong in a few days. For now, take care. Bye-bye. You can blame me. Try to shame me, and still I'll care for you. You can run around, even put me down, still I'll